Bonjour, je vous remercie d'être venus si nombreux pour assister à la rencontre avec Guy Gabriel Kay, à qui je laisse la parole immédiatement.
Bonjour. I asked Sean if I could make some remarks before we began, because this is my last appearance on the stage, and it gives me an opportunity to say how much I appreciate the invitation from Jeanne and her colleagues to be your guest at Utopiales in Nantes. And I want to particularly mention something that you may not be fully aware of. I have been so impressed with the panelists all through the last several days, the ones I've been on, the ones I've caught, and I've been so impressed with the audience at the level of intelligence and passion for books and thought and ideas. The contrast between what normally happens at a convention in North America actually gives me hope for science fiction and fantasy readers and writers retaining a passion for books and the written word and the sharing of thoughts and ideas. You have actually inspired me here over the last few days with your patience, with my speaking to you in English, with your attention to and interest in everything that's been said on this stage and the others. I think it's been a wonderful, for me, few days. I am filled with respect and admiration for Utopiales and its organizers and all of you. I'd like to thank you for the invitation and for the reception.
You can go now.
One more thing before you start. I want to make a particular thank you to my ghost whisperer on my left, Bernard, who is facilitating the process up here by telling me whatever Jeanne says, unless she says something that is so dangerously funny about me, he has promised to be gentle in what he tells me.
Je fais confiance à l'homme qui parle à l'oreille de Guy Gabriel Kay. Guy Gabriel Kay, vous êtes né le 7 novembre 1954. À deux jours près, à la fin du festival, nous aurions pu vous fêter bon anniversaire, mais je suggère qu'on le fasse en avance. Bon anniversaire, Guy Gabriel Kay. En 1974, vous commencez des études de philosophie à l'université du Manitoba et vous les interrompez pour suivre Christopher Tolkien en tant qu'assistant pour la rédaction du livre Le Silmarillion, abandonné par son père à cause de sa mort, ce qui est une bonne excuse à mon avis. Cette rencontre exceptionnelle part du fait que votre famille connaissait la famille de l'épouse de Christopher Tolkien. Vous quittez donc le Manitoba pour Oxford pour mener cette tâche à bien avant de revenir au Canada en 1976 et vous y obtenez un diplôme de droit en 1978. Vous êtes d'abord scénariste de la série radiophonique The Scales of Justice jusqu'en 1989, produite par Radio-Canada. Mais vous publiez à partir de 1984, la grande trilogie de Fiona Var, qui recevra un très bon accueil, si bon accueil que son tome 2, Le Feu va vagabond, sera lauréat du prix Casper, ce qui est l'ancien nom du prix Aurora, pour le roman anglais en 1987. Vos romans suivants, Tigane et La chanson d'Arbonne, rompront définitivement avec la high fantasy. Ils s'inspireront directement et respectivement de l'Italie et de la France médiévale. Tigane obtiendra le prix Aurora en 1990, et viendront ensuite les Lions d'Alrasan, relecture de l'Espagne de la Reconquista, puis la mosaïque de Sarans, à laquelle je me suis permise de faire un clin d'œil parfaitement répugnant derrière. Donc, la mosaïque de Sarans, qui est un reflet de l'Empire byzantin sous le règne de Justinien et Théodora. En 2005, le dernier rayon du soleil, roman nordique et viking, tandis que Isabelle, en 2007, bénéficiera du doux climat de la Provence et d'un World Fantasy Award. Et en 2010, vous commencez votre visite de la Chine ancienne. Alors, enfant, vous rêviez d'être écrivain, avocat ou joueur de hockey. Vous êtes bien devenu écrivain, vous avez presque été homme de loi. Est-ce que le hockey vous tente toujours ?
Oh, of course, of course. Not till my birthday. When I have my next birthday, I am officially retiring as someone who thinks he can play professional hockey.
J'espère que vous nous enverrez des photos. Si la philosophie paraît une source évidente dans votre œuvre, tant dans la politique, entre guillemets, de vos romans, que dans les recherches fondamentales de vos personnages, ou bien quant aux thèmes qui traversent l'ensemble... Tu me dis si je vais trop vite.
Non, c'est bon.
C'est bon. Qui traversent l'ensemble de votre travail, qu'en est-il du droit ? C'est une discipline exigeante, basée en partie sur l'histoire, bien qu'elle appelle ça la jurisprudence. L'argumentation est en cœur de son sujet. Cette formation de jeunesse est-elle l'une des sources où vous abreuvez votre inspiration, ou votre technique d'écrivain ?
Argumentation?
Yeah, argumentation in the legal sense of the term.
At the core part of the books?
Yeah.
That's a wonderful question. Yes, in the sense that I think that human conflict plays out in a remarkable number of different ways, and not only the obvious military, physical conflicts between people. I think that any fiction that we want to hold the attention of readers, in fact, to hold the attention of the writer while writing it, needs to involve that element of conflict. But Shan is right in that I do believe that there are subtler and different ways of exploring conflict rather than the obvious. One example, she mentioned the two books inspired by China. And in the first of those, Under Heaven in English, there is in fact a poetry battle between two brothers. That's one of the climaxes of the novel. And what I wanted to show with that, it was one of the hardest things I wrote in that book, because whenever you write a song or a poem in a book and you're going to announce that it's good, that characters respond to it as something good, it has to be the best you can manage. And in that battle between the brothers at the court, what I wanted to show was that danger, conflict, danger, risk, can arrive in many different ways within a historical or a fantastical setting, or even, frankly, in a contemporary setting. That argument, debate, a poetry battle can be just as tension-filled, just as risk-containing as two people with swords in a combat. I've done those scenes too. But with every book, I'm looking for different ways to explore the idea of conflict. So I think Shan is right. Argumentation, debate, verbal conflict can be the essence of a battle just as much. I'll add one more thing. Argument and debate as in the English language world we know from Shakespeare in Beatrice and Benedict, can also be remarkably erotic, that two people in their verbal battling, their back and forth bantering, can work as a foreplay towards an erotic resolution. And if the wit is genuine, if they're genuinely funny in their battling, then the reader comes to respect the intelligence of those characters far more. This is a show not tell thing about writing. If any writer, myself, anyone else at this conference, spends a book telling you my protagonist is the smartest woman in the kingdom, and the protagonist doesn't say anything particularly witty or insightful, the reader ends up with a question mark in their mind about the legitimacy of that observation. One of the challenges of writing, for me, for any of us, is to actually deliver on someone, with someone, who is alleged to be really clever, really witty, really subtle. You have to deliver the words that the reader then believes that the character has the traits that you're attributing to them. It's one of the most difficult and most enjoyable, for me, aspects of writing, is to try to create genuinely clever people that you will feel are clever people.
Même s'ils se trompent.
Even if they're wrong. Even if they're wrong.
Oh, well, someone doesn't have to be right to be clever.
Absolument. So, j'abondais dans ce que tu disais.
Yeah, with agreeing in front of what you're saying.
Alors, La tapisserie de Fiona Var, votre premier roman publié, reprend un certain nombre de mythes connus, ce que ne faisait pas Tolkien, mais aussi d'archétypes connus. Cela, c'est très tolkienien, très fantasy classique. Pensons par exemple au peuple des cavaliers dans Fiona Var, ou les religions de la mer, ou l'arbre de l'été lui-même, qui nous renvoie à la recherche des runes, la découverte de la magie, etc., dans la mythologie nordique. Alors, diriez-vous que Fiona Var, c'est à la fois votre adieu à Tolkien et votre propre voix que vous avez trouvée dans, dans cette trilogie. Je voulais faire un jeu de mots idiot avec le tome 2 et puis je l'ai perdu.
Shan and I have been discussing this since I got here. And it's a very interesting, complex issue for any artist to look back at their own origin story and analyze what they were doing, why they did it, why they changed. I'll make a couple of observations, or we'll be here till 5 o'clock debating this one. First, when I wrote the Fiona Var tapestry, it was about 10 years after my work on the Silmarillion. It wasn't immediately after, it was a decade. I wrote a book before that that was about North Americans backpacking through Europe. It was a contemporary novel. It was never published, but it was my gateway to being published because the editors who saw it said, we don't think we can make money from this book, to my agent, but we'd like to see what Kay does next. And what I did next was Fiona Var. And the reason I hesitate when we've discussed this to talk about the book as a farewell was because the actual angry impulse I felt when I wrote The Summer Tree and then the sequels was my sense at the time in the 1980s that all of my peers, my contemporaries, younger writers in their 30s, once upon a time I was 30, younger writers of fantasy who had ambition, who believed in the genre, were abandoning the epic scale, abandoning what we now call in English high fantasy. We're beginning to work in urban fantasy. It has a different meaning now, but in the 80s, urban fantasy tended to be smaller scaled fantasy where the supernatural and the magic elements came into the present day. People like Charles de Lint, Emma Bull, Megan Lindholm, who later changed when she used the name Robin Hobb, were writing smart, well-crafted fantasy novels that left the field of the epic to the writers who were doing unembarrassed, reflexive clones, copies, imitations of Tolkien. My writing of the trilogy wasn't so much a saying goodbye to Tolkien at that point, it was a defending of the idea that epic fantasy did not only have to be a copy, an imitation, a bowing down to the much-loved Tolkien. I loved him too, obviously. I worked on the papers. So what I wanted to do with that book was say that there is still vitality, there is still passion and power in epic fantasy if you go back behind Tolkien to the same roots and origins that he did in myth and legend and, Sean mentioned, archetype of figures that inspired him. So when I wrote the trilogy, it was actually an homage to the materials that he had been drawn to and worked with. Where you are right, and I will give you this, where you are right about the farewell was that I didn't want to stay there once I'd finished. I made the Fionnabar tapestry my statement about the continued importance and vitality of epic fantasy in the 1980s. And then I didn't want to write what I called, as a joke, a four-volume trilogy. I didn't want to keep doing the same thing. And I was young, I was stubborn, I didn't have debts. That made a difference. And I moved to doing something completely different for me, and at the time, for the fantastic, when I wrote Tigana. Tigana was a conscious decision, and this is why Sean's right, to say, I will say goodbye to working in that particular vein. I have said something I think matters to me in that field. Now I want to see if I can say something completely different with the fantasy genre. So it's two different things. The inception of the trilogy wasn't about saying goodbye to Tolkien, but the moving on to something else after was. I hope that makes sense.
En tout cas, ça y ressemble beaucoup. Du coup, j'ai envie de vous demander, est-ce que un écrivain comme George Martin colle à votre goût de l'épique?
Somebody like George Martin, George R. R. Martin, fits your idea of epic.
That gets really complex again. The problem with an intelligent interviewer is the questions need 20-minute answers, which I won't do. I don't like discussing my peers in specific literary terms. What I'll say, and George and I have actually discussed this in other ways, my worldview as a writer, not just as a fantasy writer, but my worldview as a writer, and frankly, my view as a person, is not aligned with what we say in English is the grimdark fantasy mode, the idea that has sometimes been said, Frodo and Sam wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes in George Martin's world. Therefore, that world is more realistic. Realism, and this is why it's a 20-minute question, realism is an extremely complex thing in literature and, frankly, in reality. And my view of the world all my life has been that it includes violence, cruelty, greed, selfishness, arbitrariness, all of these things that the newer strand of fantasy valorizes, if the word prioritizes. But it also includes courage, love, friendship, honor, respect, morality. All of these things exist in parallel with the other elements of the more realistic fantasy that is mostly dominating today. I have spent my entire career killing characters. I am very happy to kill off characters if the book and the story requires it. I have a murderous streak within me. I only look gentle. Don't be fooled. But, two things seem to me central to how I approach something like that. One is, you need to care when a character dies or is wounded emotionally or actually. If it just happens and you don't have a response to it, I have failed, and frankly, anyone has failed in the scene that that conveys. That's one thing. The other thing is that the violence of the world exists for me in parallel, in conjunction with the potential of the world and the story for something else, for something that has to do with dignity and honor and ethical behavior by people. I want to give you books that offer both of these things because I think it's a richer literary experience and a more realistic presentation of the way most of us try to move through the world.
Ça m'amène à une remarque que je m'étais faite en relisant votre œuvre ces derniers mois, c'est qu'une constante dans votre œuvre, c'est la problématique du choix. Vos personnages choisissent de vivre, d'agir ou de mourir selon leurs propres règles et aucune autre. C'est assez évident pour Darien, qui est un des premiers pour moi, qui est un des fondateurs de cette problématique du choix. Mais il y a aussi les deux protagonistes mâles de Al-Rassan qui sont ennemis mais qui se respectent et qui se retrouvent au face à face et qui choisissent. Donc il y a aussi le général Rendayan qui va à la mort en le sachant. Donc et ça c'est un projet chez vous, cette problématique du choix. Ça revient à ce que vous disiez tout à l'heure.
She's very good.
Faut qu'il arrête.
First of all, yes. I'm not feeling argumentative now. First of all, yes. The idea of choice began for me right in the Fionnabar tapestry when I made it one of the themes of the book, which is that each individual has responsibility or capability of making their own ethical choice in our society or in the society of the novel. That we all are responsible for what we do in the face of political danger, ethical disgrace. We make our own choices. And those choices are often difficult. And in Fianavar, working in the mythic, legendary world and scale, they were profoundly difficult. They can cause death for the self or for others, the choices we make, because they do. Because choice carries weight and a burden. So Sean is right that that was part of my literary world and ambition from the very beginning. With Lions of Awasan, Leon d'Awasan, again, you're right, the shift there was that I wanted to write a book where I created some of the most powerful, charismatic figures I could. The two men who are the lions of the story and the woman who knows them both. I wanted them to be strong figures. I always want that, but in this case, there was an additional reason. The reason is this. The more I read and the more I thought about what happens when the world moves towards a holy war, towards a religious conflict or any ideologically driven conflict, that forces people to take a side based on their birth, their country, their formal allegiance, not their personal feelings. I wanted Lions to be a tragedy about the removal of choice. You see, we're talking about people having a choice. In Fianavar, I explored that. By the time I'm writing Lions, I'm creating a world where the religious conflict that is the bedrock of the novel strips away the free will, the choice, the ability to decide for yourself, even among the most powerful and charismatic people I could create. And I wanted to suggest that one of the great defining evils of something like a holy war is the way in which it removes from us our own ability to take our own choice and live our life consistent with that choice. We become pieces in a machine, elements of an army. We are no longer autonomous in our own right. So Lions was a novel that flipped the idea of choice, turned it around by taking it away from the characters in the book. And my hope, frankly, was to have you weeping at the end of the book, not just for the lives of the characters, but for the implications of what happened in a world where this takes place.
Alors, vous avez fait une allusion à la religion. Or, justement, bizarrement, la fantaisie est souvent décrite comme un genre escapiste et dans Arbonne, comme dans Al-Rassan, le thème central de la religion est très prégnant, mais surtout l'utilisation cynique du religieux à des fins politiques. Seulement, ces romans sont, pardonnez-moi, anciens. Est-ce que, si vous deviez réécrire un roman ayant ce thème-là maintenant, vous, que feriez-vous en fait? Exactement.
This really interests me as a question, as a subject, about fantasy and what it can do that other forms of literature might not be able to do as well. So religion, for me, in Lions of Awasan, is the best example. It's the most recent book available in France. It's a reprint from an earlier edition. I didn't want to engage with the doctrines and faiths of belief. I'm not that presumptuous. What I wanted to engage with is the conflicts that can emerge from any beliefs that come in collision. So the actual religions in the book involve people who worship the sun, or the two moons of that planet, or the stars. I'm not, and deliberately not, working with doctrine and faith in our world. I'm working with what happens when whatever you believe in collides violently with what someone else believes in. So in that book and in others, the exploration of religion, it's about the social conflict that emerges, not the religious doctrine that underlies it. And my point here is, and it's been borne out by the fact that of all of my books, the one that keeps seducing Hollywood is Lions. There have been flirtations with other books, there still are right now. But Lions is the one they have kept coming back to because they understand that it might allow them to explore the idea of what happens in holy war and religious conflict without offending, stepping on toes, disturbing people by commenting on what they believe. Because the beliefs aren't the story, the conflict is the story. And of all the books, Lions is the one where film and television keep coming back to look at ways of optioning it for a variety of reasons. It hasn't happened yet. For a variety of reasons, it is still possibly the most likely to happen in the near future because of that idea of fantasy, letting religion be a motif without disturbing people in their own beliefs.
Eh bien, justement, ça m'évoque quelque chose que vous aviez dit lors d'une de nos rencontres, c'est que dans votre fantaisie, il apparaît, lorsque les gens croyaient en quelque chose, c'est à ce moment-là que ce surnaturel-là apparaissait. Est-ce que c'est une forme de, est-ce que c'est une façon de démontrer ce respect pour les, pour la religion, tout en critiquant effectivement
What Sian has just brought up is leading us into at least two different parts of why I use the fantastic to explore history. Here's one that's directly on her question. I have always felt that there is a risk in historical fiction, even the best historical fiction, of modern readers feeling superior to the characters in the book from the past because of the silly things they believed, as we see it in the modern day. In the two books based on Byzantium, people believe that if you threw a curse tablet in an open grave, cursing anybody, that curse would come true. That was a part of the belief of 6th and 7th century Byzantium. In China, in the 8th century, the Tang Dynasty, the belief in ghosts was central to the culture. An unburied person remained a ghost haunting the place where they died until they were properly laid to rest. In Celtic, Anglo-Saxon, Viking days in the north, the belief that forests and mounds were haunted by, inhabited by, fairies was central to how they understood their world. So, if you write a historical fiction novel and a character believes in fairies, the risk is that a modern reader will feel smug, superior, we know so much more about the way the world really is. So what can I do by adding the fantastic to history? I can give value I can give understanding to the characters by making the world be as they understood it to be. If they believe there are fairies in the wood, if they believe unburied soldiers remain ghosts until they're buried, I will write a book that honors that, that respects the way people understood the world. And if I do it right, and I've been trying for a long time now, if I do it right, the reader of my novel, my historical fantasy, might come away from the book with a more empathetic, compassionate, intelligent understanding of the way people lived in the world 1,200, 1,800 years ago. For me, this is part of respecting the past, as Shan put it, that we respect the way they saw the world differently from us, and we don't feel superior to them because of that.
Alors, du coup, ça m'amène directement à ce que vous voyez défiler à l'écran. J'ai essayé de retrouver les lieux qui correspondaient au roman de Guy Gavriel. Et la question que je me pose, c'est que vos livres ne s'inscrivent pas seulement dans une histoire, ils s'inscrivent aussi profondément dans une géographie. Alors, ma première question, c'est entre Arbonne, Al-Rassan et Isabelle, on est dans le sud de l'Europe. Vous avez un lien particulier avec le sud de l'Europe ?
I was probably lived in Provence in a previous incarnation. And I spoke French. Actually, I may have spoken Provençal, so that's a wholly different issue. I have a moving as in it moves about, connection to different parts of the world and times in history. Most of it has been European. But I've written two books about Byzantium, and I've written two books about dynastic China. So I no longer feel tied to the history of Europe. There's no question that as a person, I have a deep love of Aix-en-Provence and the countryside around it. I've written there four different times. I have my favorite fromagerie, and I have my favorite cafes. And so you could say that it's a deep personal connection to a part of the world. But one of the things we say in English that gets me up in the morning, that keeps me going as a writer, is trying to learn something new. There is a far too common phrase in writing classes where the instructor will tell the student, write what you know. I say no. Write what you want to know. Write about what excites you to learn and discover. It's one reason I can't write an 8-volume book, because I already know the space that book takes place in. I want to finish a book about Byzantium and then discover the Vikings. And I want to finish that and learn everything I can about the Tang Dynasty in China. The idea of learning and discovering and immersing myself in different times and places is what excites me as a writer. My hope becomes, and I can't prove this, but I've always felt that when a writer is excited by his or her own journey of discovery in a book, that comes through to the reader of the book on a subliminal, subconscious level. They pick up the feeling of discovery that the writer has. It's one reason I don't outline. Here again, I resist the writing instructors who say you should always outline your book, and I resist the instructors who say an outline will make it a formula. I tell writers, write whatever way works for you, because it's so damned difficult that if you find something that works for you, go with that. What works for me is not knowing exactly where my story is going as I write it. I'm finding out just ahead of the reader, perhaps just ahead of the executioner, where the novel wants to go. And that energy is both in the moving around geographically and in the discovering the actual story as it unfolds. They come together to be part of what excites me as a writer.
Et alors justement, ça donne un tempo particulier à votre œuvre, un rythme doux qu'on vous a parfois reproché un peu. Mais est-ce que ce tempo, c'est celui de votre découverte de l'univers, de l'espace et de l'histoire?
Another terrific discussion topic. Part of the challenge of moving around the way I just described, moving in cultures and times, is that you can't, or you shouldn't, for me, write a book about Vikings with the same language and the same pace as you write a book about Song Dynasty China. They have different internal rhythms. The language and the cultures operate differently. And if the writer is showing respect, as we discussed, the pace and the rhythm of the books should not be identical. So I actually don't want the novels to have the same pace. I don't want them to have the same language. This is one of the things we discussed in the very first panel I did here in the other room about how a writer, when translated, is completely at the mercy of the translator. It that the translator understanding that aspect of language and pace for a particular book is not something a writer can control. I know this from French-speaking friends, that Michael Cabon did a remarkably strong job translating my last two books here in France. If I won awards for those two books, it has to be in good part, because of my translator, because he's my voice in French. And so the challenge of trying to vary the language and the rhythm is hard enough in English. You come to realize that when you're in French or Polish or Chinese, you're depending on another person to have enough understanding to carry that over for you, and you don't know. It's a really interesting aspect of international publishing. I love it, I'm grateful for it, but I don't know how I sound right now in Italian, because I don't speak Italian. I can hope that I sound at least a little bit the way I want it to sound.
Pour avoir lu en anglais et en français, je vous jure que c'est la même chose. Alors, j'ai envie de parler d'un autre type de voyage, celui que vous menez à travers vos propres livres, en semant ici et là des allusions, des clins d'œil et parfois carrément des personnages invités de Fiona Barr. Et je me doute que vous avez déjà répondu à cette question mille fois, mais par contre, je n'ai pas trouvé la réponse. Donc, pourquoi est-ce que vous faites ça? Est-ce que l'intertextualité de Fiona Var est importante pour vous et pourquoi?
That whole question of the writer's journey through life is a terrible thing to ask someone right before their birthday. It's because you become aware of... Let me address that. I think about this a great deal. Because readers will come up in a signing lineup or online, and they will say, please write another volume in the Fiona Var tapestry. Please write a sequel to A Song for Our Bon. Now, it's not just that stubbornness I spoke of, where I said I don't want to repeat myself. It's something else. I really believe that if we are writing the same way at 60 as we wrote at 30, I really believe something's wrong. One of two things has happened. We haven't grown as a person in those 30 years. We haven't changed in 30 years, or in some cases of very, very commercially successful writers, they have chosen deliberately to stay with the formula that made them successful 30 years before. And most of the time, it's the books from 30 years before that have freshness and energy, because after 30 years, this is my point, after 30 years, if you're doing the same thing, you're out of love with your own writing. So for me, when you talk about the journey of the writer, the journey of the writer is the journey of any person living through their life. It is being a young person, getting married, having children, the deaths of parents or friends, the changes of politics in your world, the changes of climate and the environment that you face in your world. If these things don't change you, and therefore change what you want to say when you sit down at your desk as someone who believes in literature and art and the relationship between a committed writer and a committed reader. If you're not changing through your career, I think you're making a mistake. You're closing yourself off to new things you have to say. So what I have to say now will not be identical to what I wanted to say when I was 28 or 35. Now, there's one more aspect of this that I really want to make clear. No writer should complain if a reader says, well, I like the new book, but 25 years ago, when I read Sailing to Sarantium and Lord of Emperors, those were the books that spoke to me. Because writing and reading are a dialogue. We both bring something to our relationship. We have a relationship. I have to tell you, we have a relationship. It's not just me or Jeanne with her books. It's not just us making a speech, presenting a monologue. It's us in exchange, in interaction. And you bring your taste, your mood, your life at that moment to our dialogue. And I know you have all had the experience, I know this, of picking up a book and reading it and saying, meh, doesn't work for me. And 5 years, 10 years, 1 year later, you pick up the same book and you think, wow, this is wonderful. because we as readers change too. It's not just the writer who's changing, it's the reader who is changing in so many different ways. So that different books or the same book can speak to us powerfully, whereas once they didn't speak to us at all. That idea of dialogue between writer and reader is always in my mind.
Alors, la dernière question, j'espère que vous aurez le temps de m'y répondre, sauf si vous me dites, non, pas, c'est pas du tout ça. Dans le fleuve céleste, vous décrivez une situation où on interdit aux femmes l'accès au savoir par réaction à la prise de pouvoir de l'ancienne impératrice, ce qui nous rappelle d'autres Tsui, d'autres Nefertiti, d'autres grandes reines qui ont vu juste après leur règne arriver une réaction terrible. Et je ne peux pas m'empêcher de penser qu'il est possible que ce n'est pas pour rien dans le contexte actuel que vous avez pu écrire ce livre-là sur ce sujet particulier.
And we've got 4 minutes on this one. We're doomed. You have to ask great questions with 4 minutes. Okay, very quickly. I've spent my whole life as a writer wanting to have powerful, complex female characters with what we say in English, with agency, with room to maneuver and contribute and make a contribution in their world. I have also been conscious that history, times and places, has often resisted that agency for women. And it would be dishonest as an artist to ignore that. So the tension has been to look for ways in my research, to look for ways in the record of the past to have female characters who have that kind of control or ability to aspire to control. So, for example, in Lions of Al-Rasan, I learned that there were female physicians in the medieval times in Spain, and it gave me a license, it gave me permission to work with a strong female physician character, because history allowed it. When I wrote River of Stars, the most powerful theme that came right from the start had to do, and it's just a good ending note, it had to do with how the lessons we learn from the past can be the wrong lessons. It's been said that those who don't remember the past will repeat it. It's equally true that those who remember the past badly can create new forms of disaster. And in history, the Song Dynasty of China, 250, 300 years after the great Tang Dynasty, took two lessons away from the fall of the Tang. One was that soldiers were dangerous, that the rebellion that destroyed the Tang was so violent and extreme and destructive that it was a good idea to have an incompetent army because they could never threaten the emperor. The obvious problem with that is the incompetent army also cannot defend you from an external threat. The second lesson they took away, it's quite astonishing. The second lesson was that allowing women to be in the room when important matters are being discussed is a bad idea. Because there had been an empress in the Tang Dynasty who was accused of having led to all the troubles of that time. So the Song was notorious for pushing women into the inner chambers, out of the way, And from these two false memories of the past, I shaped a novel to try to explore the idea that we need to remember our own history. We can't live in the world without knowing our own past, or as somebody said, we're like children all our lives. We need to remember our history, but we need to think about it and remember it carefully. And so the constraints on women in River of Stars are partly my attempt to show the foolishness of the way that memory contributed to destroying a dynasty.
Alors, hélas, c'est fini. Merci.
Oh.
Merci vraiment.
Merci beaucoup.